one of the lectures has to go. So the second lecture on cinema no longer exists, and the class will carry on, as it says in the reader, from now on. So this week, Milo Ponte, next week, some of the Deleuze and Guattari texts that they wrote together about art and art history. Okay, this is for this week, 2 pages this week, so take 2 and pass it on. How many people have done a course about phenomenology or nobody? Is it not taught in the department? Who's still? German phenomenology, Heidegger. Yeah, but not the French tradition. No. Merleau-Ponty.
Levinas.
Okay. All right. Well, you might have to be a little bit patient because we're kind of diving into it today. And if you haven't got any background, then it might be, well, I hope it won't be too difficult. If anybody has questions, just stop me and we can talk about things in more detail. All right, so when I was talking about Kant, when I spoke about Kant, I mentioned that the transcendental subject he erects as the condition of possibility for thought and experience will find, at least according to Deleuze, a more contemporary echo in phenomenology. Alright, so Kant, we remember, provides or discovers this transcendental dimension, a kind of transcendental subjectivity, which gives us the conditions and possibility for experience and for thought, for generating concepts. And we talk quite a bit about that. And we remember that Deleuze says, this is the first quotation on the quotations page, Kant can be considered as the founder of phenomenology. So many of the same issues discoveries that Kant makes in relationship to the transcendental are going to be, extended and explored by phenomenology. So Kant's great discovery of the transcendental is going to found phenomenology on a dimension that is immanent to appearances and acts as their condition, but nevertheless does not appear as itself. This will be, in Merleau-Ponty's terms, this is in fact the name of his last book, The Visible and the Invisible. So there is going to be the visible, which is going to be the starting point for all of phenomenology's discussions. But this visible is going to have transcendental conditions of possibility, which are going to be, according to Merleau-Ponty, invisible. Now, in a very general sense, we can see that Deleuze himself, I tried to talk about this a little bit in the last few weeks, is also concerned with the transcendental, field. It's actually a term he takes from Merleau-Ponty. A transcendental field, which gives the real conditions for real experience, which is, as I tried to mention last week in terms of Bergson, the virtual and the actual. So if we wanted, this is not the right way to do things, but let's just imagine we can draw a parallel between Merleau-Ponty and Deleuze. For Merleau-Ponty, there is the visible and the invisible, the transcendental, the actual world, empirical perception, the actual, and the invisible conditions for perception, which is, in Deleuze's terms, the virtual. So, when we're talking about the relationship between Deleuze and Merleau-Ponty, it's really this relationship that we have to think through. We have to think through what are the similarities and what are the differences between Merleau-Ponty's visible and invisible and Deleuze's actual and virtual. These are questions that both concern the development of the transcendental, let's call it field, as it was, let's say, discovered by Kant and as it is continued on within, first of all, phenomenology, but also Deleuze. The Visible and the Invisible is a book that was written, although it was never finished, in 1962. It was the book that Merleau-Ponty was working on when he died, and it was then published after his death, about three chapters, along with the working notes that Merleau-Ponty was making for the book at the time of his death. And for most people, this book represents a certain kind of important development for Merleau-Ponty's own thought, and there has been quite some discussion as to the extent to which Deleuze was influenced by this kind of last phase, if you like, of phenomenology, or at least the last phase of Merleau-Ponty's work. I'm going to try and talk a little bit today about these similarities and differences, but hopefully what I really want to do is try and give you a sense of the differences, because this somehow is the most important to understanding Deleuze's own use of, or own understanding of, the transcendental as a plane of immanence. All right, so this dimension of transcendental conditions remains ideal in Kant. We've seen how it is a form of an idealism. And in fact, Deleuze and Guattari argue that in this sense, Kant forms part of a very long tradition of philosophy concerned with the operations of the cogito. So in other words, a form of philosophy that begins with Descartes and actually travels through Kant and finally ends with phenomenology, and particularly Husserl, which are all philosophies which, this is the second quotation on the page, in which the cogito makes it possible to treat the plane of immanence as a field of consciousness. Immanence is supposed to be immanent to a pure consciousness, to a thinking subject. So this is going to be crucial for phenomenology. For phenomenology, it's going to be, let's say, the experience of the world as it occurs to a thinking subject, which is going to define the plane of immanence. So for Kant, it was this transcendental realm of the categories and the ideas that grounded the uncertainties and infinities of perception. We remember in the Third Critique the way that the transcendental ideas come back in the face of the sublime to kind of confirm the subjectivity or the subject who experiences. But we also remember that Deleuze is going to follow Salomon Maimon in criticizing Kant's kind of the way he erects a transcendental set of transcendental ideas as a kind of replacement for God, if you like, but doesn't actually explain where these ideas come from. And Maimon Deleuze is going to follow Maimon again by looking for the transcendental, but this time not ideal, but real conditions of experience, or the real conditions of real experience. And this involved a move from transcendental ideas as ideal conditions of experience to virtual, but real ideas inseparable from the actualization that expresses and constructs them. This, very briefly then, is the transition from a Kantian transcendental idealism to a Deleuzian transcendental materialism. I've talked about this before in the essays, not just on Kant, but Nietzsche and Spinoza as well. The question for us today is where we can locate phenomenology, and particularly Merleau-Ponty, within this transition from transcendental idealism to transcendental materialism. So where are we to place Merleau-Ponty on this kind of shift? Deleuze and Guattari will argue that in Kant, the process of thought discovers a transcendental subject as its own immanent condition, and that phenomenology marks the modern moment of this discovery. In phenomenology, first of all in Husserl, the plane of immanence is understood as being the flux of lived experience of a subjectivity. But because important aspects of this experience do not belong only to this subjectivity, and in fact transcends the subject, phenomenal experience constitutes a transcendental field as a plane of immanence. In other words, phenomenology is going to say, well, we experience objects, but actually it's the experience which constitutes the objects, not the objects which constitute the experience. And therefore, if we want to discover what constitutes the world, we have to understand what constitutes experience, because in fact it is experience which constitutes the world. Which is going to make a whole lot of trouble, of course, because once you take that approach, then you have this big problem, which is, well, how is it possible that there are other people in the world? Yeah, it's the classic problem with Descartes, which is solipsism. So it's like, well, if my experience constitutes the world, then how do I know that I'm not just the only person in the world and I'm just making it all up? Yeah. So phenomenology is going to have to overcome this problem of solipsism. And the way, one of the ways, or the most important way perhaps it's going to do it, is by positing this experience not simply as, let's say, my experience, but experience itself as the transcendental field, as what in fact is shared, yeah, by everyone, as what constitutes being itself. That being itself is going to become visible in the process of experience, in the process of a phenomenal experience, an experience of phenomena. Yeah. So it's going to be by seeing that being is going to come, let's say, into, or is going to become visible. Anyway, we can say that. Yeah? But there are nevertheless going to be elements of being and of its becoming visible, which will remain invisible. Yeah? And these elements, I'm going to try and develop this much more today, these elements are going to be, in effect, the elements which make up the phenomenological cogito. That is, sentience, the process of thought, consciousness. Consciousness is going to be transcendental because it's going to be shared by everybody. Yeah? But it's going to be a kind of invisible condition or structure of visibility itself. And it's going to be the relationship between these two things, what Merleau-Ponty calls visible and invisible, which are going to account not only for the, let's say, coming into visibility of being, but are also going to constitute in a very important sense, and this is where Heidegger is also going to be important for Merleau-Ponty, it's going to constitute a very important sense of being itself. Being itself is going to have a kind of differential existence. It's going to be difference, which is going to be genetic. That is, difference will be the ontological term, as it is in Heidegger. Being is difference, yeah? But this difference is always going to involve a kind of absence. And this is the point where Deleuze is going to draw a line between himself and Heidegger as well as Merleau-Ponty. Okay, that's a kind of a short summation of where we're going to go today. So let's see if we can figure it out. All right. So, phenomena are original in relationship to the objective world. That is, our experience of objects, let's say, precedes their objective existence. Yeah? We can't say anything about their objective existence without having an experience of them. And it is through phenomena that the objective world is known to us. So, phenomenology is going to try to find out how this object is constituted through phenomena. So it's going to examine, let's say, the processes of perception, the way in which a phenomena appears to us, in order to try and establish something about the world. All right. So I've got this long quotation now from Merleau-Ponty's another extremely important book by Merleau-Ponty. This one was first published in French in 1945, called Phenomenology of Perception. He says there, at the same time, the phenomenal field becomes a transcendental field. Okay, I tried to explain that. Since it is now the universal focus of knowledge, consciousness definitely ceases to be a particular region of being, a certain collection of mental contents. It no longer resides or is no longer confined within the domains of forms, which psychological reflection had first recognized. But the forms, like all things, exist for it. It can no longer be a question of describing the world of living experience, which it carries within itself like some opaque datum. It has to be constituted. The process of making explicit, which had laid bare the lived through world, which is prior to the objective one, is put into operation through the lived through world itself, thus revealing, prior to the phenomenal field, the transcendental field. This new reduction would then recognize only one true subject, the thinking ego. So first of all, the phenomenal field, that is appearance, experience, is posited as being, let's say, transcendental, in as much as this is all we've got to go on. And if we want to find out anything about the world, we have to understand how it is that we come to experience the world. Yeah, because the world for phenomenology is only given to us in phenomena. This is what he calls the lived through world, with the lived in world. Yeah? This is going to involve a whole series of terms in Merleau-Ponty, lived experience, the lived body, and so forth and so on. This is all terminology which wants to locate our bodies in their relation to the world and those relations as being what constitutes the world. Yeah? So this lived world, these lived experiences that constitute the world, are prior to any sense of an objective reality. But within, let's say, the phenomenological project, that is, as we try to analyze these experiences, these perceptions, to try and understand what it is that is in them that we can call objective, or that we can at least say is a shared world, we must consider and reflect on those experiences. And this is going to involve another element to, let's say, the problem, which is going to be that not only do we have to deal with sensation or sensing, which is exactly our lived experience of the world, but we also have to reflect upon this experience in order to understand what in it, yeah, is, let's say, just my hallucination, and what in it is actually, let's say, something objective, which we can understand as being shared amongst everybody or understood by everybody. And this new reduction, as Merleau-Ponty calls it, is the emergence of sentience or consciousness as the necessary complement to sensation or the sensing body in the phenomenological inquiry. And it's going to be exactly understanding what the relationship is between this, as Merleau-Ponty calls it, sentience and this sensation that is going to constitute not just, let's say, the force of the phenomenological inquiry, but it's actually going to constitute being itself. We'll hopefully see how that's going to work as we go on. All right. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to include a lecture about Leibniz, but this would be exactly the place where Leibniz becomes very important, because Leibniz is a crucial reference not just for phenomenology, but also for Deleuze. And it's an understanding the differences in the readings of Leibniz between Merleau-Ponty and Deleuze that it's, I think, most, let's say, philosophically precise way of understanding the differences between their thought. For those of you who are interested in this, the Deleuze's book, The Fold, has some discussion of these different readings of Leibniz between himself and Merleau-Ponty, if anyone wants to have a very ambitious essay topic. Okay. So, the problem with this whole project from Deleuze's point of view is that because the plane of immanence is conceived of as the flux of lived experience, phenomenology will succumb to the same criticism that is often directed at Kant, that, as Deleuze says, phenomenology remains, this is a quotation from Logic of Sense, which is a book that where Deleuze discusses Husserl in quite a lot of depth, phenomenology remains, he says, satisfied with creating the transcendental out of the characteristics of the empirical. This is a famous objection to Kant that was also put forward by Heidegger in Heidegger's reading of Kant, but which Deleuze also echoes. And now he also accuses phenomenology of the same problem. So it means that you've got this lived body of experience, this perceptual sensing body, which is kind of located in the midst of things. It's a plane of immanence, of pure experience, of sensation. Now, this is exactly the point where Merleau-Ponty comes close to Deleuze. But because of the necessity of a kind of a reflection or a process of consciousness which complements this sensual body, yeah? There is going to be a certain transcendence which is going to be generated out of this field of this transcendental field of sensation. There are going to be these invisible structures which are going to condition this field, but which at the same time must come from this field, which means, Deleuze says, these moments of transcendence can only ever take the form of a kind of subjectivity which pre-exists it. That is, this subjectivity of the lived body, yeah? My experiences. So the transcendental conditions, invisible transcendental conditions of experience, are going to be generated out of this field of immanence, which is nevertheless depending upon a bodily or an embodied lived experience. So it means that this, finally, this transcendental condition is only ever going to be able to, in a way, mirror or reproduce the kind of subjective limits of lived experience, or of the lived body, as Merleau-Ponty calls it. So that phenomenology is finally going to run up against the same problem, at least in Deleuze's way of looking at it, as Kant did. In other words, it's not going to get us past the human all too human, as Nietzsche puts it. This is like one of the most fundamental kind of criteria for Deleuze. It's a fundamental criteria for philosophy, that philosophy must precisely go beyond the image of thought, which depends upon a common sense, which kind of defines the human, if you like. Just as art must give us sensations, which are the affect, percept, inhuman becomings of man and the inhuman becomings of nature, this must be the criteria for a, as I talked about it before, a kind of a sublime art. So whenever we are discussing these sort of alternative aesthetic theories, such as Merleau-Ponty, we must always bear this in mind, that Deleuze's criticism is going to weigh very heavily on this point, because any philosophy which cannot get us beyond human sensations or human thought is simply never going to go further than just reproducing all the same old clichés and opinions that have come before. It's not going to produce the real task of both philosophy and art, which is to produce something new, to overcome, in Nietzsche's sense. Okay, so that's going to be the problem with phenomenology. In many ways, however, Deleuze inherits a lot from Merleau-Ponty. Not just this kind of visible-invisible structure, or virtual-actual, in other words, but also, and this is perhaps more significant, the idea that art expresses the emergence of being, and by examining art, and particularly the paintings of Cézanne, we can see something of being. We can see, and indeed our very vision is, an emergence of being. I won't say itself, because it's not clear that being emerges as itself in art. But anyway, being emerges and becomes visible through art. And one of the most interesting elements of comparing Merleau-Ponty and Deleuze is that both Merleau-Ponty and Deleuze situate Cézanne as a crucial moment in, let's say, the trajectory of art towards being. Yeah? Or to put it another way, the moment at which art takes on a truly ontological role. Yeah? That it is actually art which becomes privileged in Merleau-Ponty's account, and perhaps we could say in Deleuze's account, something that we should perhaps think about more as we go along, that art is privileged exactly because it reveals something ontological, it reveals something of being which is not able to be approached in the same way by philosophy or by science. So this is something that they have in common, and if we have enough time, I'll come towards the end of today to talk more explicitly about the discussions of Cézanne, Merleau-Ponty, Deleuze. Finally, however, Deleuze is going to reject Merleau-Ponty as being too Kantian, because too ideal, and too Heideggerian, because for Merleau-Ponty, genetic difference will always be a type of absence. I'm going to come back to both of these and try and play them out in a bit more detail as we go along. Deleuze's own position is closer to Sartre, by whom he was very deeply influenced. I mean, you could almost construct a kind of alternative course where we could have a class on Leibniz and a class on Sartre and so forth and so on. But maybe that's for another semester. Okay, if we look at the next quotation, Deleuze and Guattari, they say, Sartre's presupposition of an impersonal transcendental field restores the rights of immanence. This aspect of Sartre was extremely influential on Deleuze, and it was also a very important dialogue slash argument that was held between Merleau-Ponty and Sartre at the time immediately after the war. So both Sartre and Merleau-Ponty were, let's say, arguing over the nature of the transcendental field, and most particularly its relationship to a form of subjectivity. And where Merleau-Ponty wanted to construct a kind of transcendental subjectivity, Sartre was much more interested in an impersonal transcendental field that had these kinds of gaps or absences punctuating it, within which no subjectivity could emerge. So Deleuze and Guattari write, Sartre's presupposition of an impersonal transcendental field restores the rights of immanence. When immanence is no longer immanent to something other than itself, it is possible to speak of a plane of immanence. This is something that Deleuze and Guattari talk about over and over again. If a plane of immanence is immanent to something, if immanence is an immanence to something else, then it's not really immanent. Yeah? So immanence can only be immanent to itself. It cannot be immanent to something else. The danger with something being immanent to something else is that the first thing remains immanent within the second thing, but there is always the possibility that something in the second thing is not immanent to the first thing. In other words, there is not what Spinoza calls full univocity. Being is not said in the same way of all of its dimensions, that there remains the risk that part of it remains outside of another part. Such a plane is, perhaps, a radical empiricism. Deleuze also talks about a superior empiricism. It's a kind of another name for this tradition that he builds, starting with Hume, the book on Hume. So, a radical empiricism, it does not present a flux of the lived that is immanent to a subject and individualized in that which belongs to a self, which would be phenomenology. It presents only events. So, events are kind of the name of what happens on this prepersonal transcendental field. It is events which don't have a subject, they are not immanent to a subject, and they are not individualized in relationship to a self. This is precisely going to be the problems that Deleuze is going to find in Merleau-Ponty. Okay, despite all of these things and the way that I've kind of laid this out so far, you know, it's really, the relationship between Deleuze and Merleau-Ponty remains quite ambiguous. And I think this ambiguity appears strongest in the book on Francis Bacon, where Deleuze does seem to employ a phenomenological vocabulary, and he draws very heavily and not necessarily critically upon the phenomenological writers Honoré Malamé and Erwin Strauss. So these two books form a very important, let's say, basis of the discussion of painting in the Bacon book. And Deleuze seems to draw on them without making, let's say, really obvious his differences from them. So this is one of the reasons why it's not particularly easy to kind of tease out the differences. So I wanted to give one example of this, and that is the next quotation, but a long quotation. where we see Deleuze really kind of adopting a phenomenological vocabulary. He writes, "Sensation has one face turned towards the subject, the nervous system, the vital movement, instinct, temperament, a whole vocabulary common to both naturalism and Cézanne, and one face turned towards the object, the fact, the place, the event. Or rather, it has no face at all. It is both things indissolubly. It is being in the world, as the phenomenologists say, at one and the same time I become in sensation and something happens through sensation, one through the other, one in the other. And at the limit, it is the same body which, being both subject and object, gives and receives the sensation. As a spectator, I experience the sensation only by entering the painting, by reaching the unity of the sensing and the sensed." Okay, we're going to come back to a lot of these things when we talk more about painting explicitly. And there's a few things here which are going to be very crucial for that. That is, this idea that the body who experiences sensation is both subject and object. So again, this is a, let's say, ambition that Deleuze shares with phenomenology. And also, that as a spectator, I'm going to experience sensation only by entering the painting and by reaching the unity of the sensing and the sensed. Now, this is really vocabulary that comes directly from Merleau-Ponty, along with this term being in the world. And Deleuze seems to take this vocabulary and to use it without distancing himself from it. He will explicitly distance himself from it later in the book, and then most strongly in What is Philosophy with Guattari, he's going to say some very kind of hard things about phenomenology. But at this stage, it's as if the two projects are travelling along a very similar line. This shared vocabulary expresses all of the ambiguities of Deleuze's relationship to Merleau-Ponty, because Deleuze's use of terms such as being in the world, like in the quotation, and later on in the Bacon book, the term flesh, is going to give a kind of distorted echo that I think we can say departs from the phenomenological lived body to finally be posed against the lived body and its flesh. I say departs from because it's like, it's as if Deleuze picks up the question from phenomenology, in other words, departs from phenomenology in the sense of beginning from phenomenology, but at the same time also departs from phenomenology in the sense of going in a different direction from phenomenology. So this is the kind of ambiguity that he shares a lot of the same concerns with phenomenology, this idea of sensation being both subject and object, this idea of joining the painting and the unity of the sensed and the sensing. These are things he shares with Merleau-Ponty. So Deleuze departs from Merleau-Ponty in the sense, but he's also going to change these terms and understand them in a very different way from phenomenology. And so in this sense, it's also going to depart from phenomenology in the sense of doing something different. The use of the term flesh in the Bacon book is a very interesting one, and also very evocative in this sense, because flesh is maybe the central term of Merleau-Ponty's last book, The Visible and the Invisible. This is the major kind of new terminology that comes in at this point for Merleau-Ponty. And it's kind of odd that it's such a central term for Deleuze's discussion of the Bacon paintings. But Deleuze's use of the term flesh is actually taken from Antonin Artaud, and so it's going to be a kind of a conflict, if you like, between Artaud and phenomenology around this term flesh. So we're going to try and understand what this flesh is as we go along, and then we might have a better way of understanding where Deleuze draws the differences. But just to go back to that quotation from the Bacon book, we can already see that there are going to be some differences between the projects, inasmuch as Deleuze says that it is sensation and not the lived body which is being in the world. So this is going to be important. It's not the lived body which is being in the world, it is sensation. And this means the unity of sensing and sensed, rather than what Merleau-Ponty calls their reversibility. I'm going to try and explain this more as we go along. So Merleau-Ponty is going to call the relationship between sensing and sense a reversibility, and Deleuze is going to say that in sensation you have a unity of sensing and sense. It's an important distinction. I'm going to try and play it out a little bit more today. The second element that comes from the quotation, which indicates a certain difference, is that this being in the world for Deleuze is both a becoming in and a happening to the world. We could say, I become in the world, that is an inhuman becoming of man. Yeah, it's the definition of an affect. And it is a happening to the world, a becoming of nature or a percept that makes the sensation, according to Deleuze, the expression and the construction of something beyond lived experience. So this becoming in and happening to the world of sensation is going to go beyond what Deleuze is going to end up calling the paltry lived body. It means the weak kind of lived body. So he's going to suggest a kind of, let's say, vitality or a kind of life that emerges in sensation through art that is going to take us beyond this phenomenological lived body, so beyond its human dimensions, as I mentioned before. Okay, so what I want to do now is try and look a little bit more closely at Merleau-Ponty, and especially at this last book, The Visible and the Invisible. The central term in this book, and it's Merleau-Ponty's term for the plane of immanence or transcendental field, is the flesh. The flesh, for Merleau-Ponty, is the site of what he calls incarnation. Okay, the late Merleau-Ponty becomes full of these kinds of religious terminology. We're going to have transubstantiation, incarnation. There's going to be a whole set of religious terms that, in fact, is going to be carried on by phenomenology in France after Merleau-Ponty's death. It's going to have a considerable... It's going to continue on for a considerable time, in fact, up to the present day. And it's going to really embrace and explore this kind of religious dimension of Merleau-Ponty's work. So the flesh, he says, is the site of incarnation, the place where sensation and its invisible conditions appear in what he calls the reversibility, or he also calls it the intertwining of sensing and sensed. So the flesh is going to be the flesh of a lived body, of lived experience. It's going to be a flesh which is a transcendental field. It's going to include everybody within it. It's going to include subject and object. It's not individualized. And it incarnates certain transcendental conditions for that sensation. It's going to incarnate invisible conditions which will be defined through this reversibility of sensing and sensed. We have to remember, again, our question at the beginning. What is the difference then between Merleau-Ponty's incarnation and Deleuze's actualization? What is the difference between these two terms? This is going to be a fundamental way of understanding the difference between Merleau-Ponty phenomenology and Deleuze. Okay, we'll try and come back to this question as we go along. Okay. So, this intertwining or reversibility of sensing and sensed, how does it work? Merleau-Ponty describes it in terms of colour. His example is red. I think I've mentioned before, it's amazing. It's always red. Philosophers always talk about red. It's never green or blue or white or black. It's always red. It's incredible. You can read almost any philosopher and they're going to talk about red. Okay, so it's red. Read. So we sense this colour red in things. We see red. We see red in the Coke bottles and so forth and so on. But how does this red become red? Merleau-Ponty argues that it emerges through a process, a virtual process, it means not a process occurring in the actual world, a virtual process of differentiation between not only the different reds that we see, but those reds in other colours. Yeah? So that it's always through relations of difference that something in the visual world is going to appear to us. That it is exactly these differential relations which remain the kind of virtual and invisible condition for what it is that actually appears within perception. So this redness itself, let's say, redness itself, not the red of the Coke bottle or of somebody's shirt or whatever, but redness itself, yeah, is actually not a thing. In fact, it's going to be invisible, yeah, and it's actually a structure of differences which give us our experience of red, or that experience of red. So this differential structure, this virtual structure, and we can already see the echoes of Deleuze are very strong, because for Deleuze the virtual realm is also the realm of differences which are actualized in things. Yeah? And so for Merleau-Ponty you have also this kind of differential relation between reds and reds and other colors and so forth and so on, which form the invisible condition of the visibility of reds. And it is this redness which is neither an object nor a sensation of an object, but is in fact a kind of ontological substance which enables objects and sensations' emergence. And in this sense, it is entwined, or there is a relationship of reversibility with the visible itself. So, in other words, you cannot have the visible without this invisible condition. Yeah? It's not possible. At the same time, you can't have this invisible condition, redness, without having red things in the world. Yeah? If there were no red things, then we would have no invisible, yeah, condition of redness. But there is also a kind of reversibility, which means that you never find redness in a red thing, just as you never find a red thing in redness itself. You know, you can't have, you need both, but they always exist in this kind of circle They circle around each other. They're never ever present to each other. Okay, we have to keep this in mind, because now this is going to be the kind of Heideggerian dimension of Merleau-Ponty, which is going to be a problem for Deleuze and a difference from Deleuze. This is going to be the beginning of the idea of a differential, which is going to involve a necessary absence. The difference is going to always involve a necessary absence, and that's not the way that Deleuze is going to think about difference. All right, our sensation of a red thing, Merleau-Ponty writes in The Visible and the Invisible, is, this is the next quotation, a red thing is a momentary crystallization of coloured being or of visibility. Between the alleged colours and visibles, we would find anew the tissue that lines them, sustains them, nourishes them, and which for its part is not a thing, but a possibility, a latency, and a flesh of things. So, the flesh is the condition of possibility of both seer and seen. It is, as Merleau-Ponty puts it, the formative medium of the object and the subject. So the flesh is equally object as it is subject. As a result, this is Merleau-Ponty now, the thickness of flesh between the seer and the thing is constitutive for the thing. This is the next quotation, actually. The thickness of flesh between the seer and the thing is constitutive for the thing of its visibility as for the seer of his corporeity. The body. It is not an obstacle between them, it is their means of communication. So, this is where we're starting to get a sense now of this, the transcendental aspect of the flesh. It's not the thing that divides object from subject, it's the thing which connects them. The flesh encompasses subject and object as the medium of both the active sensing of an object and the passive sensibility of a subject. It is their reversibility, the reversibility between an active sensing and a passive sensibility, the sensing and the sensed. It is their reversibility which forms the incarnate principle, that's what Merleau-Ponty calls it, the incarnate principle of an anonymous visibility or vision in general. So the flesh is incarnated in vision, but in itself remains the invisible and immanent element of vision, what Merleau-Ponty calls the sensible in general. The flesh as sensible in general is what enables, Merleau-Ponty says, the return of the visible upon itself. Now this is what the first quotation was also suggesting, that, okay, if everything is vision in this way which phenomenology kind of insists upon, then we are going to have to, let's say, look at vision and visibility in order to try and get a sense of what they might be. This would be the phenomenological project. So the return of the visible upon itself. We have to look at what is the visible. What is this flesh as the condition of visibility and as what is seen? So this implies that vision is also, or could also be, a process of reflection by which the flesh is able to see itself, by which the transcendental field is able to, let's say, form an adequate idea of its own existence. Vision therefore implies and requires the sentience of the sensible, as it does the reversibility of seer and seen, in what Merleau-Ponty calls the carnal adherence of the sentient to the sensed and of the sensed to the sentient. So, in other words, this is the moment at which the cogito returns. So, there is going to have to be a kind of consciousness of the flesh, that the flesh is going to have to become conscious of itself in this process by which visibility is going to, let's say, look at itself in order to make its own visibility, let's say, qua being, visible. It's always this kind of circles within circles, right? This is always going to be the perennial problem of phenomenology. So, it means for Merleau-Ponty that this kind of return of the visible upon itself is going to require a cogito, a consciousness, in order for there to be a kind of sentience of the sensible. Yeah? You know, it's all very well for us to be sensing, living, you know, the lived body, lived experience, engaged in the phenomenological world, but Merleau-Ponty is a philosopher and he wants to ground this experience, yeah, in order to be able to make a statement, an ontological statement about what is. And in order to do this, he's going to require this reflective process which is going to introduce sentience and consciousness back into the process. We'll see how that works. So, the carnal adherence, the kind of physical connection of sentience and sensation, is the lived body. This is a body of sensations involving both a sensed and a sentience that senses it as they emerge immanent to each other. So in other words, I have my sensations. I am a living body. I am in the world. I am being in the world. My lived body is in the world. I am having these perceptions. And all of my understanding of what might be objective or objects in the world only comes to me through these sensations I have of them. Yeah? That's the transcendental field. That's where we start the investigation from there. But then I want to understand, well, what is the nature of this relation? Yeah? And how might there be elements within this experience which are not just my experience, but which are actually objective? Yeah? This is Kant's basic aim, right? Is to discover these things which structure experience and which therefore are not simply elements of my experience, but are transcendental. They are elements of all experience. They are conditions of any possible experience. So, in this sense, Merleau-Ponty is after something similar. But in order to do this, in order to reflect upon my experience, upon my sensations, in order to, let's say, make them visible, yeah, to make visibility visible, is going to require this extra dimension of sentience, this extra dimension of a consciousness. And it is this consciousness which is, let's say, incarnated in the experiences of the body. Yeah? Let's see how that works. The sentience is going to involve the operation of what Merleau-Ponty calls a ray of natural light which illuminates all flesh and not just my own. So sentience is going to be exactly this element of experience which is going to go beyond just, let's say, my experience, and it's going to reveal a certain shared world. Sentience renders the flesh sensible in and as a lived body. The flesh, in an ontological sense, is therefore the overlapping and fission, not fusion, fission, yeah, the separation, fission. The overlapping and fission identity and difference of sentience and the sensible. So the flesh is that material dimension which encompasses everybody, is going to be constituted by this, or is going to incarnate, is going to give body an experience, give body to and an experience of this fundamental relationship between sentience, consciousness, kind of consciousness, and the sensible, sensation, the feelings of the body. Yeah? But the nature of this relationship between sentience and sensible is never going to be one of, let's say, it's going to be one of reversibility. It's going to be one of, as Merleau-Ponty calls it, fission. Yeah? It's going to be a coming together, which is also a separation. Yeah? It's going to be a coexistence, which is also a reversibility. It's never going to be a full fusion. They're not going to be the same thing. They're only ever going to appear in this kind of difference from each other. This identity and difference of sentience and the sensible forms what Merleau-Ponty calls a fold. It's also very interesting because, of course, the fold is going to be the name of one of Deleuze's books. And Deleuze, of course, knows that Merleau-Ponty uses this term fold and folding and folded over and over again in Visible and Invisible. So it's not by accident. Merleau-Ponty says the flesh is folded around a central cavity. This is immediately now also going to be the difference from Deleuze. Deleuze is going to understand folding in a very different way. But if you have the flesh as a transcendental field, and then you have experience or the lived body as being a kind of fold in this field, by which it can reflect on its own experience, yeah, in order that by which it can reflect on its own experience in order to understand what in its own experience is actually more than just its own, what in its own experience is actually transcendental. So the flesh is folded around a central cavity, one that Merleau-Ponty says is not an ontological void, a non-being, but is the inseparability of sentience and sensibility in their co-determining difference, a difference which ensures that the body and the world adhere to one another, stick to one another. So, the flesh is folded around these cavities which are constituted by the difference between sentience, consciousness, and sensation, the body. So there is this kind of foundational difference. This is the difference which structures, let's say, its incarnation in the flesh, its incarnation in sensation, the sensation of the lived body. But what structures that sensation, that lived body, yeah, is the reversibility of the sentience and sensation. This would be a clear statement supporting Deleuze's assessment of Merleau-Ponty's Heideggerian commitments. For Heidegger, Deleuze claims, non-being, and this is the next quotation, this is a quotation from Difference and Repetition, non-being refers not to the negative in being, but to being as difference. In this sense, Merleau-Ponty followed a more thoroughly Heideggerian inspiration than Sartre in speaking of folds and pleating from the phenomenology of perception onwards and in returning to an ontology of difference and questioning in his posthumous book, The Visible and the Invisible. So I mention this because this is another, this would be the other, another chapter in the course, which is not this one, which would be the course on, which would be the class on Heidegger and Deleuze, because again, there is a big question over their relation. It's a very interesting area. Nobody, I think, to my knowledge, has really developed this in a great deal of depth. But you see, the question is, for Heidegger, it's clear, and for Merleau-Ponty as well, difference is genetic. Difference is an active term which produces what is in the world. In the case of phenomenology, what is in the world is our experience, the experience of the lived body, yeah? Sensation, right? So anyway, it doesn't really matter. The crucial point here is that on an ontological level, being is defined as difference. Okay, good. So it is for Deleuze as well. But, and this is the problem with Merleau-Ponty, and especially with Heidegger, let's say, behind Merleau-Ponty, is that this difference is always going to involve an absence of one of its terms. Yeah? So it means that when we sense, you know, we sense because of this invisible, yeah, differential, let's say, process, you know, but that cannot be present in our experience of it. Just as when we think about, let's say, what is red in its redness, and we decide, along with Merleau-Ponty, that it's about a set of virtual differentiations from other colours and other reds and so forth and so on, that this also cannot be present in our experience of a red object. So there is always the sense, I'm going to talk a little bit more about this, in which, to use Heidegger's terms, visibility is always a veiling and unveiling of being, yeah, at the same time. So when I see something, I am seeing, let's say, the coming to visibility of being, but in becoming visible, there is something of being which is also remains invisible. So in unveiling being, I am also experiencing its veiling. Now, this is the classic Heideggerian terminology, right? That every unveiling is a veiling. That you cannot ever get to being itself, because being itself is always the difference between being and a being. The big B and the little B in English, anyway. So, this is where Deleuze puts Heidegger's where Deleuze puts Merleau-Ponty's understanding of the flesh and the sentient, the relation between sentience and sensation on the Heideggerian side, and says that this remains another problematic aspect of it. Okay, so this genetic difference, a moment of hiatus, as Merleau-Ponty calls it, is illustrated by his famous example of a hand touching a hand that touches. Okay, a hand touching a hand that touches. My hand touches the Coke bottle, and this hand tries to touch. So it tries to touch the hand touching. It doesn't mean to touch the hand. It means to touch the touching of the hand. But I can't. Because,
I just thought about to see the scene, to hear hearing.
Yeah, exactly. It's this idea. So, I cannot touch the hand touching. Yeah. Merleau-Ponty. does he say? Where am I? Mm-hmm. All right, he says, it's the next quotation. My left hand is always on the verge of touching my right hand, touching the things, but I never reach coincidence. The coincidence eclipses at the moment of realization. It means the moment that I touch my hand, the hand just simply becomes an object of touch, and that the touch itself disappears, or it's not touchable. This is the sense in which sentience and sensibility never come together, but always come together. You can't have touching, you can't touch a thing without having this touching. But as soon as you touch a thing, although you can touch a thing, you cannot touch the touching. So they never come together except as the missing part that folds the flesh into a sensation of its permanent difference from itself. So in effect, that is what we are sensing. We are sensing this kind of core difference, this cavity, as Merleau-Ponty calls it. And the flesh is permanently being folded around this cavity of reversibility between sentience and sensation. This is this unbridgeable gap, this chiasm, as Merleau-Ponty calls it, a chiasm of sentience and sensibility, which marks the imminence of seer and seen in the flesh, but the chiasm itself transcends the flesh. In fact, Merleau-Ponty suggests the term imminent transcendence, and this chiasm, this reversibility acts as the ideal condition of all ontological emergence. The central ungraspable cavity constitutes the flesh, the paradox of expression, is what Merleau-Ponty calls it, of the flesh, the folding of a sensation around its invisible conditions, giving us both what is and isn't expressed. So in other words, we cannot have these invisible, we cannot have a sensation without its invisible condition. Its invisible condition is in fact this reversibility or chiasm between sentience and sensation. Yeah? And this difference is itself, let's say, non-materializable. In fact, it is, Merleau-Ponty is going to tell us, an idea. Yeah? So it's going to have a kind of finally, despite all of Merleau-Ponty's attempts, it's going to end up with a kind of ideal formulation. Deleuze will argue, in opposition to this, that sensation does not express this untouchable and transcendent element, but rather expression is inseparable from what it simultaneously constructs. This is what I've talked about before, that the virtual cannot be separated from the actual. It's a very important element of Deleuze's philosophy, particularly important after Logic of Sense, so after he meets Guattari, where it becomes a much stronger theme. So you cannot have this ideal dimension. So the virtual cannot be an ideal dimension. Okay, I've talked about this before, and we'll come back to it again. This is exactly what Bourdieu says Deleuze does, that Deleuze is he calls Deleuze a Neoplatonist, yeah? Because he sees the ideas, virtual ideas, as forming a kind of Platonic realm, which are then actualized in the world. So this is, of course, to my way of thinking anyway, exactly what Deleuze tries to resist, yeah? Especially after he starts work with Guattari. So it means that the fold for Deleuze is in and it is of matter, entirely immanent, rather than being the expressive paradox by which sentience, Merleau-Ponty's version of the cogito, appears as a structuring absence. For Merleau-Ponty, the flesh expresses an, this is Merleau-Ponty's words, interior armature which it conceals and reveals, an armature of lines of force and dimensions. But despite the similarities of these terms with Deleuze, finally, Merleau-Ponty will write, this is the next quotation, the experiences of the visible world are the exploration of an invisible and the disclosure of a world of ideas. We can get a sense of what these invisible ideas are by referring to Merleau-Ponty's discussion of painting in his essay, I and Mind. Merleau-Ponty discussed painting and drawing and art a great deal. In fact, similar to Deleuze, I mentioned this before, for Merleau-Ponty, art is a privileged expression of being. So art has an ontological function and even preeminence in Merleau-Ponty's thought. Why? Because art is the realm of sensation. So obviously for Merleau-Ponty it's extremely important because he's interested in lived experience. He's lived in the senses, phenomenology. Merleau-Ponty mentions light, shadow, reflection, and colour as being these structuring ideas for the appearance of art, but they are ideas which what he calls profane vision, another kind of religious idea, so profane vision would be the vision which doesn't think about the bigger questions. Profane vision forgets these ideas. But these ideas, light, shadow, reflection, colour, they work on the same way as the example of colour. They're differentials. Yeah? They are differences which structure the appearance of the artwork. This is going to be similar to what Deleuze argues as well. He's going to argue that colour is a differential. He's going to draw upon Goethe's Farbenlehre to understand colour. That is, he's going to reject Newton's, let's say, science of colour in favour of Goethe's differential understanding of colour. We might be able to come back to that in some of the later lectures. So these differential relations or qualities of light, shadow, reflection, colour, etc. form what Merleau-Ponty calls the diagram of, let's say, a painting or an artwork, the diagram, as he says, the parent, the genesis, the metamorphosis of being into its vision. So this differential relation forms, or this series of differential relations forms a kind of a ideal structure or diagram by which being becomes visible. Painting attains this privileged ontological status then through incarnating an invisible diagram in what Merleau-Ponty calls, again another religious term, halos of being. So a painting is like a halo of being. It's like a kind of a light that is emitted by being. So the painting is the coming to visibility of being. Yeah? But in becoming visible, yeah, there is in order to become visible, it requires this invisible diagram, yeah, in order to become visible. But in becoming visible, It will be this invisible diagram which cannot be seen, or which cannot be visible itself. So this is this kind of Heideggerian element that in order to become visible, being requires or must pass through this diagram of visibility. But in becoming visible, it's precisely this diagram which must remain invisible. So that when being becomes visible, it also becomes invisible. That you cannot have one without the other. This is this sense in which difference requires a certain absence. And for Deleuze, difference will never require an absence. Yeah? Difference is always a fully positive relation. Alright, so the flesh of painting or of drawing acts as a screen, this is Merleau-Ponty again, acts as a screen that both reveals and conceals its invisible diagram, which, as the example of the touching hands showed, retreats in the measure we approach. That's what Merleau-Ponty says. It retreats as far as we approach it. So as long as we keep like seeing it and moving towards it, it's always going to be going back because it's a screen which allows itself to become visible, but which also hides it. Yeah? So we can never get beyond this form of visibility, this way in which being and becoming visible also makes part of itself a part of itself which is not separate from the part of from its becoming visible. It's actually the condition for its becoming visible, but that part must always be invisible. Yeah? And this is the way in which Deleuze says phenomenology makes transcendence out of immanence. Yeah? That we have this plane of immanence, which is the field, the transcendental field of experience. We are all living bodies, yeah, experiencing world. And from this experience, through this experience, as the conditions of this experience, phenomenology creates these elements which transcend that experience. These are finally what Merleau-Ponty is going to call the ideas, these structuring differences around which the flesh is folded, the folds incarnating these ideas. Okay, so painting and drawing render visible the process of ontological emergence, and as such, they paradoxically express and conceal the being of this being. This is Merleau-Ponty's formulation, it's directly Heideggerian, being with a big B of being with a small b, beings being objects in the world with a small b, and being being precisely this ontological term for, let's say, existence, which is always veiled as it is unveiled, which always becomes invisible as it becomes visible. Painting, for Merleau-Ponty, is a technique of the body which illustrates and amplifies this metaphysical structure of our flesh. This is how Merleau-Ponty describes it. Being, in this sense, is a light cast on the flesh in which I am one with what I sense. But this being in the world is a presence-absence, a veiling-unveiling as visible expressive paradox. As a result, seeing, this is the next quotation on the pages, seeing, for Merleau-Ponty, is not a certain mode of thought or presence to self. It is the means given me for being absent from myself, for being present from within, at the fission of being, only at the end of which do I close up into myself. So Merleau-Ponty explicitly has this idea that by examining the processes of perception in the visual field, we are going to have an understanding not just of subjective perception, but beyond subjective perception to a sense of the way in which, let's say, the transcendental field, being itself, becomes visible, yeah? And that this is going to take us out of a purely subjective, empirical view of the world, and is going to reveal to us a sense of the shared world, the transcendental field, if you like. But Deleuze exactly is going to intervene on this point, and he's going to argue, as I tried to explain at the beginning, that if this field of experience, yeah, is anyway already based upon the experiences of a lived body, that is, of a human body, yeah, as well as a brain or a consciousness which somehow complements it but is not of it, then we already have begun from a position by which we can never get any further than a transcendental subjectivity as the conditions for that experience, which simply reflect those conditions, or simply reflect the conditioned, that is, where these conditions have been drawn from, and cannot move beyond them. So as long as we begin with the experiences of my body, my experiences, yeah, even though I'm able to move to a transcendental plane which explains, let's say, conditions that are shared by everybody, so I'm able to go beyond my simply solipsistic empirical position to something of transcendental conditions, those conditions are only ever going to reflect where they came from, which was my empirical experience, the experience of my body, my lived body. Yeah? And this, in the end, is going to be the same problem, according to Deleuze, that Kant also had. Yeah? That you don't get very far with the transcendental field if it's only ever modelled upon subjective experience. If that's where you're starting from, then you're never going to get very far. So Deleuze is going to try a much more radical operation than that, which is to separate sensation from any kind of subjective belonging. Yeah? So a sensation is never my sensation or your sensation. It's just a sensation. It is itself, he says, a living being. And so you only start from the level of the sensation. You do not start from the level of my experience or my sensation. Yeah? So it's going to be a very different beginning point, but I'll talk more about that anyway as we go along. Okay, so sensations for Merleau-Ponty express the coming to be of the coming to be of the world, but they, Deleuze and Guattari say, are not successive contents of the flow of immanence, but acts of transcendence that traverse it. These transcendental acts are trajectories of truth, that's what Deleuze and Guattari call them, trajectories of truth, emerging from a belief in the essential truth of perceptual experience, which is the foundation of phenomenology. This comes from Husserl. Husserl called them urdoxa, which is a kind of, it is the assumption of the essential truth of my experience. Yeah? And Husserl basically begins from the assumption of this truth in order to, let's say, go anywhere at all. So if you're not going to assume the truth of certain fundamental aspects of experience, then you can't actually go anywhere with it, because if everything is just a personal hallucination, then nothing can be said about the transcendental field. And this is another interesting element of phenomenology in relationship to Deleuze, which is that, you know, at its beginnings, or at least with Husserl is one of these kind of what became very unusual philosophers that were both analytical philosophers, or what we now call analytical philosophers, and continental philosophers, because he basically tried to address this problem that logic had, which was, you can set the conditions for truth or falsity, yeah, according to a establishing a logic, but how can you guarantee that these statements to which you are assessing for their truth or falsity actually have a real connection to things in the world? That's the bit that logic can't ever actually establish. So what do you do with that? So Husserl tried to found a kind of analytic logic upon what he called a transcendental logic, which was a base for assessing truth or falsity of propositions, that was a way of actually being able to ground those propositions in the actual world. And these erdoxa, as he called them, was a way of doing it, which was to say, well, when I say, you know, this is a chair, then it's possible for me to understand the statement as being true because there are various constitutive aspects to that perception which cannot be doubted, which must be true. Yeah? And so this is also is going to become what Merleau-Ponty is going to explore, but he calls it gestalt, yeah? So gestalten. So it's like, well, when I say this is a chair, there are various aspects of that perception, like, say, figure-ground relationship would be one of the classic ones, yeah, which you can't doubt that. That's a constitutive element of the perception itself, and therefore that is true. And so this is a way of being able to move then from assessing the logical truth or falsity of the proposition, this is a chair, yeah? Okay, it's possible to do that according to a kind of logical analysis, but according to that analysis, you're not able to actually say whether what you saw was a chair or not a chair, right? Because the proposition itself is not able to establish that. So it's possible then to provide a kind of phenomenological grounding, if you like, for logical statements. And this is what Husserl tried to do. Deleuze and Guattari have a great kind of, in What is Philosophy, they have this rather vicious attack on analytical philosophy, and they say that, you know, phenomenology is the only form of continental philosophy that analytical philosophy will allow, you know, and there are, like, you know, 90% of the department is analytical, and then 10% is allowed for phenomenology, and then most of the semester is spent with the analytical philosophers trying to destroy the phenomenologists, you know. But nevertheless, they still need them for this one kind of annoying element in analytical philosophy, which is that you can't ground it in experience. So they need phenomenology, but they kind of hate it at the same time. Okay. I don't want to say whether that's true or not, but it's an interesting moment because, you know, there's always the story about Deleuze and Guattari that they're the great affirmative philosophers and that they only say good things about everybody and so forth and so on. It's not true. All right. All right, so we come then to the second to last quotation of the page, which is the kind of summary, if you like, of Deleuze's final position. It's in Francis Bacon. He writes, "The phenomenological hypothesis is perhaps insufficient because it merely invokes the lived body. But the lived body is still a paltry thing in comparison with a more profound and almost unlivable power." This, of course, is, we've already talked a little bit about it, this is the will to power, this is what Deleuze and Guattari will also call inorganic life. I'm going to come back to that when I talk about Waringer and the way that Deleuze and Guattari use Waringer. This idea of a transcendental vitality that cannot be separated from a transcendental materialism, you know, which is completely impersonal, which does not begin from any kind of subjective reference point, yeah? So which goes beyond the lived body, which goes beyond, you'd say, subjective experience. Yeah. So if we think back to that first quotation from Francis Bacon, when he writes, "As a spectator, I experience the sensation only by entering the painting, by reaching the unity of the sensing and the sensed. So in order to have a sensation, we can say that we must go beyond the separation of the individual, of the I in front of the painting. We must enter the painting, and we must reach the unity of the sensing and the sense. This will be a sensation. The sensation will be, in other words, radically non-subjective. It will not be a subjective experience, because it will only emerge once the I, once the ego, the cogito, etc., etc., has been left behind, has been, in Nietzsche's terms, overcome. Okay, are there any questions? Well, it was kind of difficult and dense today, especially because if nobody has really any background in Merleau-Ponty, but we need to do this because to understand what Deleuze and Guattari are going to write about art, which is what we're going to be moving into from now on, we have to understand this basic kind of difference from phenomenology if we're to get any real idea about what sensation is going to be for them. So next week we're going to carry on talking a bit more about art and art history, and I'll see you then. This is a kind of an exploration then of, let's say, the creative force of the virtual realm, the realm of differences, but embodied. Yeah? Because that's the problem with the eternal return, is that the eternal return is just a concept. How do you embody that concept, It's hard enough to even think it, right? So how do you embody it? So then it's like, it's almost the opposite of that in terms of the egg, which is like a totally banal example. It's like an egg. It's just like something
that happens. But it already contains all potentialities.
Well, that's, I can't remember the details of the discussion, but you have to go back to it and look, because he wants to construct a kind of alternative genealogy of biology, which is going to understand differentiation or individuation in a way which is not simply determined by the possible. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Because it's a very important distinction that comes from the possible and the virtual. So the virtual is not the possible, because Bergson says possible is always determined by the actual. So, in other words, what is, you know, the possible uses of a Coke bottle? It's like, well, it's determined by the actuality of the Coke bottle as to what its possibilities might be. But that cannot be the virtual, because the virtual is not determined like that. It's not limited, in other words, by the actual. Virtual is precisely the kind of eruption of a certain chaotic energy.
But if we stay with the fourth time, I think the embodiment would be that everything is actually possible, that you can agree with all differences. That's the way I read it now. Where you have this object X, object equals X, and it can be every place.
Yes, it can be, but the point is not what it can be, the point is what happens.
Yeah, it actually can be.
So, in other words, possibility is of absolutely no use if it doesn't create anything new. Mm-hmm. And in effect, Deleuze wants to say that possibility can't create anything new, because actually its possibility is already determined by the action.
Mm-hmm. But if we go to the eternal return, you actually take one of these differences. So, and then you again are confronted with this universe of possibilities. It's always between performing something and being able to do something.
Your act, your affirmation, expresses the whole of the universe, not as, let's say, a snapshot, a frozen moment, but in its continual coming to be, in its becoming. So your affirmation, your act of overcoming expresses the universe in its own living process.
But by doing so.
Yes. And in other words, you have been, your moment, understood now as a temporality, has been unleashed from chronology, from cause and effect. It means that the virtual and the actual are now, let's say, a single circuit. That every actual moment affirms every virtual aspect. I don't want to call it possibility. Every actual moment.
But what happens in the moment of performing? Because I somehow can understand this moment of being able to do this.
Yes,
but what happens if you do it actually?
The sublime moment.
But if you take the action,
it's like a pure ecstasy.
Yeah.
This is where the kind of mystical elements of Deleuze's thought come back. You see, it's kind of ecstatic in this Heideggerian sense.
But as soon as you perform, you are in.
I mean, according to
Heidegger,
this is an agony.
What is it?
It's an agony.
Agony. Okay.
I mean, also for Nietzsche. You know, the pain of childbirth, he calls it, that's the eternal return. The overman comes out of me. But this is a birth, and birth is really painful. It hurts. Yeah? So it's a kind of an agony, ecstasy, a kind of a cosmic vision that is at the same time a kind of absolute annihilation of my individuality. It is, you know, this momentary expression of the all. You know, it's according to Spinoza.
Yeah,
pure intellectual joy.
But as soon as you do it, as soon as you jump into the volcano or whatever, what's then?
Then you bring something back.
Okay, and then you are again in front of this.
And then you have to do it again.
Yeah.
So that's what he says about both the philosopher and the artist.
Then I think I understand it correctly.
They go out into the chaosmosis and they bring some of it back in order to kind of pass it on. Yeah, so to learn by doing, so that, you know, we don't have to do everything ourselves, that we can learn from those who've already done it. And we can experience it, we can become one with the painting, we can enter the painting. We can enter Bacon's painting and experience the sensations that he has painted. Or we can enter Cézanne's canvas and we can feel the forces that have created the landscape or the apple. That's the transcendental field now. That's the plane of immanence, right? The forces that produce that apple, that particular apple, you know, we can feel them by entering the painting. And what does it mean for me to feel the forces that created an apple?
No, because I can follow
this.
That's
inhuman, right? That has to be inhuman. How can I, human being, experience the forces that create an apple? To experience that is to necessarily somehow go beyond my human subjectivity, my human body. So this is what Cézanne is able to kind of bring back. Yeah? He's able to experience these forces, and he's able to not translate them, but to express them in a different material, paint. Yeah? But it's the same forces. So he makes them visible, these forces. These forces being this invisible aspect, similar to Merleau-Ponty, but not so separate. Yeah. So these forces, this matter force, the matter is different. You know, it's geological matter in the case of the landscape, it's paint in terms of the painting. The forces are the same. And when I have a sensation of those forces, I am one with the painting. I experience the forces directly in my nervous system. And this creates what he calls body without organs, because all of a sudden I am dispersed. I am no longer confined to my individuality, my subjectivity, or my body, because I am experiencing the forces there.
But at the same time, he says it's a never-ending process. You can never reach the body without organs, because you can never actually come to this point.
Well, the body without organs is this kind of mysterious state which is on the limit of the livable. So the question is, how long can you survive living like that? So if you think of Arto, you know, Arto was like this kind of extremely remarkable figure because he was able to endure this incredible torment. I mean, you just need to read a little bit about Arto and a little bit of his writings and you understand it. So he's on the very, very edge of a kind of total meltdown, not just mentally, but physically he's undergoing shock therapy.
Yeah, you know, no, you can see it in pictures.
He's a drug addict. It's like he's having very violent hallucinations. You know, it's incredible. But all this time, he's producing.
But for me, it was always reading this body without organs, also to get rid of all this social constitution you already have inhaled in your life, because he is so very much at the edge. He is questioning everything that determines him.
Yes,
so therefore he's also getting rid of all of this aspect somehow.
He's not, it's not, let's say, a Rousseauian project of going back to, you know, the innocence of nature. That's nothing to do with that title, right? And I don't think that's anything to do with Deleuze and Guattari. It's not a kind of a seeking after a kind of Eden. Yeah, there is not a kind of perfect world.
No,
but there is. But romanticism is important for him. Right?
Yeah, romanticism is important, but it's not operating in this way.
Yeah, but
it's not
kind of a backward ideal.
I mean, it might be possible to run that reading, but. It's like the thing, the classic romantic model, you know, Sehnsucht and all of these things, is the individual genius who is outside of society because they seek communion with the beating heart of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah,
that's the narrative. This is not really...
I meant it in a different way. Because if you try to get rid of anything that constitutes you, it's a very painful process actually. Because you have to come back to the egg actually, because you were talking about the egg before. So
yeah,
so
right.
kind of
that's
get
right.
so organ is this kind of everything that is me somehow. So
but
in this way of
it's always a process of connection. So it's never a process of, let's say, subtraction, or it's never a process of leaving. It's always a process of reconfiguring the connection.
Yeah, but because it's so interesting. If you produce something, whatever it is, if it's a text or a picture, it's always changing you at the same time. And also this way of producing is actually a way of getting rid of something else, because it's finding something new.
Because it's never just change for its own sake. It's always a kind of change. It's a transformative change. It's never just change. Yeah? So you have to make sure that, you know, that's always clear. And this getting rid of, you know, opinion and cliche and social institution, it's never in the name of a return to a kind of pure, innocent life.
But towards a future.
It's always about creating a future.
Mm-hmm.
It's the future is always, that's the most important lesson of the eternal return. The eternal return shifts the horizon of philosophy towards the future. So it means that philosophy is now about creating a future, in other words, creating something new.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Deleuze's task. And that's what he likes in other people. Yeah? That it's never about kind of understanding what has gone before, and it's never about understanding what actually is. It's about trying to transform all of that into something new. So this is, you know, the process of overcoming, the process of eternal return, and this is the task of philosophy and art. So that's not change. Change is like not a big enough word for that. You know, that's like radical transformation. But then he also wants to say, well, actually, we do it all the time.
Maybe to place something in the world would be an interesting aspect in looking at art. Because the object itself is a kind of being afterwards.
The object itself is not
it's a difficult to
what
to
is
say
the
it,
being in the artwork is not the object but the sensation.
Yeah.
The sensation is what is alive.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference between the sensation and the material, it's not really existing. The sensation lasts as long as the material lasts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's when the material takes on sensation that the forces
both interchange, of course.
Anyway, let's go. What's the fun with the difference in repetition?